I'd like to thank Shane Rattenbury very much indeed for agreeing to be involved in this debate tonight. The Greens have played a very important role in shifting the terms of debate in the mainstream media away from questions about whether climate change is actually happening and whether it's caused by human beings, to the question of what we should really all be focused on, onto the question of what we should actually be doing about climate change. Even more importantly, by rejecting the Rudd government's original emissions trading proposal, the Greens helped to show that tossing out false solutions to the climate crisis is certainly not the same thing as opposing action on climate change, full stop, as the government, both the Rudd government and the Gillard government, tries to make out. So the common ground we can start with is that everyone here wants to see action to tackle climate change, and we're here to debate strategies for achieving that. If anyone here doesn't think that human-induced climate change is the problem, or thinks that we shouldn't do anything about it, or supports Tony Abbott's bluster, then this ain't the debate for you, and you can save time and energy all round by leaving.
Well, I think it's an absolute indictment on the social and economic system under which we live that despite having known for decades and decades that climate change poses this enormous, you know, potentially even species-ending threat, that nothing serious has been done to try to limit its worst effects. In fact, you know, worse than nothing has been done because global emissions continue to rise at an alarming rate, including emissions in Australia. And this is because we live in a society in which the economy is not controlled democratically. We live in a society in which decisions over investment, decisions to invest in new coal-fired power plants and all the rest are determined by a tiny minority of the population, by people who own large shareholdings and can determine company policy, by people who sit on corporate boards, by people at the very top of the public service, and by people who are sitting in Parliament. These people in turn are driven to continue to invest in polluting technologies because they are driven by the insane logic of profit making. Yet the line that most in the mainstream media and Julia Gillard wants to push is that the solution to the climate crisis is to take pollution and turn it into a commodity, take the profit motive and somehow use that to fight against pollution. So a quote from Julia Gillard in the Herald last year when justifying the government's decision to support a carbon tax, she said, "Putting a price on carbon is the only prudent answer because it unlocks one of the most powerful forces on earth, the genius of the free market." Presumably, this is the same genius who gave us the global economic crisis. This is the same genius for whom workers around the world are being made to suffer in many countries deep austerity measures in order to pay for bank bailouts, the same genius who has failed to do nothing about climate change for so long. The position I want to put is that rather than putting our trust in the genius of the free market, we need to look to a social force that can oppose the system overall. And that social force is the working class. And in doing that, we need to reject non-solutions to the climate crisis that attack the working class. My key argument is going to be that putting a price on carbon will actually do nothing significant to halt global warming, and in important ways will actually make the problem worse in the long term, and that what we instead need to do is look to the power of the working class rather than implementing measures which will actually cost workers financially. Okay, so it's a fairly controversial kind of a statement to argue that a carbon price will do potentially worse than nothing to prevent global warming. But think about it this way. The debate this week between the Greens and Labor has mostly been over the question of whether the carbon price will be high enough to force a transition to gas-fired power. So the Greens want a carbon price that will be high enough to effect such a transition, and it seems that the Labor Party does not. Well, even if the Greens had their way on this question, would that be a big step forward? Well, actually, gas-fired power is itself incredibly environmentally destructive. So there's a campaign going on at the moment in the northern rivers of New South Wales and in Queensland against the unconventional natural gas industry that's developing coal seam gas in those areas that threaten to poison the Great Artesian Basin. Obviously, encouraging the development of new gas-fired power plants is going to provide an important spur to those investments. Moreover, gas-fired power, while it may produce less greenhouse gases per megawatt hour than coal-fired power, is still greenhouse gas intensive. It's certainly not renewable energy. Yet we know that what we need is a transition to a zero carbon economy. We know that in the advanced industrialised countries, that's what's going to be necessary to limit the worst effects of climate change. Now, is it just a little bit of a step forward that we have gas-fired power rather than coal-fired power? Well, no, because if we create a new section of capitalists, of business owners, who have an interest in holding on to their investments in the long term, we're effectively creating a new barrier to the rollout of genuinely renewable energy in the future. We're creating a new interest group that's going to want to prevent that happening. Okay, I think this may be part of the reason why the Greens have been emphasising the importance of so-called complementary measures alongside a price on carbon to try to encourage investments in renewable energy. Now, some of these are unobjectionable enough, but I think it's important to take issue with the two main ones that exist at the moment. So one is the renewable energy target, which is actually supported by all sides of politics, all three parties. The renewable energy target will force electricity producers to to purchase a certain portion of their electricity from renewable sources.
Okay, that sounds great on the surface of it to a lefty like me, right? Forcing the bosses to do something. Fantastic. But actually, the consequence of this policy is that the electricity utilities are perfectly free to pass on the increased costs that the renewable energy target will create. So in New South Wales, there was a study recently looking into how it was that power prices have gone up 18% over the most recent year. And it found that a third of the cause of those price increases was due to policies like the renewable energy target and like the solar feed-in tariff, which is another policy that the Greens, I know, are very keen on in the ACT and New South Wales in particular. But actually, that policy is also funded from increases in power prices. The subsidy that's paid to people who stick solar panels on their roofs comes off increased power prices for everyone else. And this is amongst the most serious ways that you can hit the poor in trying to fund some kind of transition to renewable energy insofar as that's being done seriously at all. Because it's actually worse than increasing the rate of the GST because the poor have to spend a higher proportion of their income on energy-intensive goods, including electricity. And the carbon price itself, although there'll be compensation, some compensation for the price increases that that's going to cause, because companies are completely free to pass on the cost of the carbon price to consumers, we know that that compensation isn't going to cover the costs of an important section of working class consumers. So we know that although half the money, well, they haven't said exactly how much money is going to be used, but at the moment the figure being thrown around is half the money of the scheme is going to be spent on compensating low-income households. But that leaves the other half of the money to come from somewhere, and it's going to come overwhelmingly from working class households on middle incomes or a little bit above. Working class people who didn't cause the climate crisis and who shouldn't be made to pay for non-solutions to it. But I'm not just opposed to policies that hit the working class for moral reasons. I think politically it's an enormous mistake. Because it's clear that the capitalist class, the people who own businesses, the governments of the world, have no serious intention of coming to any kind of a global agreement to avert the worst consequences of climate change. If you look at the way that climate summits have progressed, basically states, particularly like the US and Australia, have done all they can to scupper any kind of serious agreement to limit global emissions. And even though that minority of states that has some kind of an interest in imposing some small cuts in emissions globally, so, you know, the states of Europe, for example, the EU has been pushing for some kind of cuts in emissions globally. But the reason they have that interest is because, for contingent historical and geographical reasons, European capitalists have less access to cheap fossil fuels. So it's in their interests to try to impose increased costs on other capitalists. But, of course, the other capitalists, the other states and governments, can simply refuse to agree to any kind of global plan. And that's precisely what we've seen at climate summit after climate summit. And even when you look at the way that the EU has achieved some limitations in the growth of greenhouse gases within Europe, this has been achieved at the cost of Europe's working classes. So the EU emissions trading scheme, because of the way it's designed, it's estimated that between 31 and 96 billion Australian dollars will have been transferred from electricity consumers, overwhelmingly the working class of Europe, to electricity producers in Europe. So even for that small minority of the capitalist class that has an interest in very limited cuts in emissions, they are achieving that through neoliberal attacks on their own working classes. That's why we should instead be supporting demands that raise the level of working class consciousness. So I think a really good demand is that we should say that the bosses should pay to roll out renewable energy. The bosses should pay to improve public transport. Because according to a recent report into how you might transition the stationary energy sector of the Australian economy to zero emissions by 2020, it's going to be expensive to do that. It's going to cost about 3% of GDP a year. Not impossibly expensive. And something you could actually write off by increasing the corporate tax rate to around 50% on one estimate. Yet clearly, our government has no interest in doing anything of the sort. Instead, they are pursuing these neoliberal non-solutions, these attacks on the working class. And more broadly, I think it's important to support the struggles of workers because they have the potential to challenge the very basis of the kind of society in which we live, the way that production is structured for profit, ignoring human need and trampling completely over the environment and causing this climate crisis that we face. So unlike bosses who have an interest in competition, in competing for profits, workers have an interest in acting collectively. Workers make gains insofar as they act collectively. So in the 1970s, the Militant Builders Labourers Federation was really important in preserving sites of environmental and historical importance in Sydney and Melbourne by acting collectively and by refusing to work on sites like the Rocks in Sydney or the Queen Victoria Markets in Melbourne, simply placing bans on those sites and therefore preserving those locations. And the working class also, unlike the capitalist class, has an interest in uniting internationally. So we've seen this really clearly with the way the Arab revolutions have progressed and developed. From Tunisia to Egypt, the revolutions have spread and deepened as the working class and those against the ruling classes and those appalling regimes have reached out across borders in a struggle across the Arab world against those dictatorships. And that solidarity has even spread beyond the Arab world. So there's a fantastic story of how workers in Egypt heard about workers in the US fighting against a Republican governor there who was trying to attack their union organising rights and push through massive austerity measures. And what they did is they rang up, they got that number somehow for a pizza place in the city where the workers in the US were organising this fight. They rang up the pizza place and they ordered lots of pizza to supply to the workers who were occupying the parliament there against the neoliberal attacks going on. So you can see that the working class has an interest in organising internationally, whereas the capitalist class has an interest in continuing to screw the environment and engaging in production for profit. So that's why I think we should absolutely reject neoliberal non-solutions to the climate crisis and instead look to the force of the working class, not only to fight for reforms in the here and now that would be worth winning, though absolutely doing that, but also having a broader orientation to get rid of the capitalist system as a whole and its destructive effects on the environment.
Shane Rattenbury is the Greens member of the ACT Legislative Assembly and the Greens spokesperson in the ACT on climate change. He has other amazing titles, but these are the important ones for today.
Thanks, Rick, and good evening, everybody. Let me start by acknowledging that we are meeting on the lands of the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of this area. Of course, and I think given Rick's introduction, it will come as no surprise to anybody in this room that myself and my colleagues in the Greens are passionately committed to doing all we can to tackle climate change. I think most of us think about it every single day that we get out of bed. But I don't think this is an occasion to talk through the science. But there is clear evidence that climate change is happening and it's driven by the human burning of fossil fuels, and it certainly poses grave risks if left unchecked. And many people have said great and powerful things about climate change. I did just want to use some words from David Suzuki as I was preparing today. These particularly struck me. He said, "We're upsetting the atmosphere upon which all life depends. In the late 80s, when I began to take climate change seriously, we referred to global warming as slow-motion catastrophe. One we expected to kick in perhaps generations later. Instead, the signs of change have accelerated alarmingly." And I thought that was a really useful way to frame the context of what we're talking about, the urgency of what we need to address. Because at its most simple, there is no doubt there's an overarching threat to the future of humanity. Climate change is the single biggest threat that we face. And I do believe it is about the future of humanity. The planet will be fine. The planet will realign itself, perhaps in a slightly different form. It's a question of whether human beings will be part of that future of the planet, or whether we're actually wiped out by our own greed and pollution. For the Greens, as I said, this is a central issue we want to address, because climate change both impacts on every aspect of our life, but it also is driven and caused by every aspect of our lives. We probably have around 10 to 15 years to prevent a climate catastrophe. Already we've put too much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, as well as the other greenhouse gases. And with scientific prediction of more frequent and severe droughts, floods, fires and storms already coming true, climate change will not only drive prices for food, water and insurance through the roof, but will also risk the livelihoods of millions of people around the globe, including here in Australia. So we simply can't afford to sit back and let that happen. As Rick suggested in his introduction, the Greens have certainly been absolutely committed to trying to find ways to get something happening on climate change. And with just 6 parliamentarians out of 226 in the federal parliament, although it will be 10 from the 1st of July, we have managed to get climate change onto the agenda in, I think, what is a way that has perhaps been boxing above our weight, if we might use that expression. We've dragged the Labor and Liberal parties onto the stage, and we have forced them to confront the issue. But having 6 out of 226 seats also means that we don't get it all our way. And we have an agenda. Our agenda is to cut emissions in a way that is environmentally effective, economically efficient and socially just. But I reckon there's a fair chance that by the time we get through the wrangling of the political negotiations in federal parliament, that's not exactly what we're going to get. And that, I think, is a difficult question. I do believe we're in a far better position than we were 2 years ago with the ETS, Prime Minister Rudd's proposal, when the negotiations were essentially between the ALP and the coalition. And between them, they dreamt up a scheme that would have locked in policy failure and delivered massive handouts to the polluting industries. Certainly a retrograde step, and one that would have locked in ongoing corporate welfare for at least the next decade. Now, there are some core principles that the Greens believe we should apply to implement policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We need early action to reduce pollution because it's cheaper and fairer than delaying action, so we need to get on with it. The equity principle has to be at the core of any policies that we come up with. And the cost of reducing greenhouse emissions and adapting to climate change must be distributed fairly, both domestically but also between nations. And I think as the wealthiest nation, or one of the wealthiest nations on Earth, with the highest greenhouse gas emissions per capita, that's a factor that we certainly have to be very mindful of, particularly sitting here in Canberra, where we have the highest emissions within Australia. So we've really got, I think, a strong moral obligation to pull our weight. The Greens want to drive the equitable transition to a low-carbon economy through a range of market-based and regulatory mechanisms to reflect the real cost of greenhouse gas emissions. Now, I see three essential steps in this process, or three key policy tools. The first is a price on carbon, because a price on carbon will send the signals and it will drive change. What we need to see is an economy that starts to account for the environmental externalities that it relies on to make its profits, because at the moment it doesn't. Now, whether it's a tax or a carbon trading system, putting a price on carbon is absolutely the key. And I'll come back to the difference between an ETS and a carbon tax in a moment, because I know it's a debate that's out there. The second key policy area is complementary measures, and Peter's touched on this to some extent. We need complementary measures because market failure is likely to happen in places. That's quite clear. Complementary measures will include policy that drives improvements in energy efficiency, incentives, and even regulation. They will also be needed to drive the development of new renewable technologies that we will need so that we can replace the current dirty electricity generation capacity. Now, one of these is a national feed-in tariff. And I appreciate there is some disagreement on feed-in tariff policies. They've certainly been getting a flogging of late, particularly by the Conservative side of politics, but also in Peter's comments tonight. And I'll come back to that also. The third thing we need is an end to fossil fuel subsidies. And this perhaps should be actually the first thing on the list. Because right now, our tax dollars are paying the big polluters to pollute more. And I think we all know these stories, the massive subsidies that go to diesel, to the mining companies. We need to turn that around and make the big polluters pay for their emissions and use the money instead to drive a cleaner and fairer society into the future. Now, I touched already on the question of which we would prefer, a carbon tax or an emissions trading scheme. It's certainly a question that's been put to me and one that's put to the Greens. Well, I think they both have their merits and their flaws, or perhaps their shortcomings. I see it very simply. They're both simply an economic tool that operates in a slightly different way. An ETS puts a cap on emissions and then the price sorts itself out from there. And certainly many say it's far more open to being rorted by traders and market players. And that's certainly a concern that I have. At the other end of the spectrum, a tax is simpler. The price is clear, but we don't necessarily know what the polluting outcome will be, and it doesn't set a cap. But of course, I have to say that I'm sceptical there won't be people trying to roar a carbon tax as well. I think it's fair to say that we live in a world where there's always a bunch of people who will try to milk the system, no matter what the system is that we create. And I don't think it's possible to create a perfect system or a perfect mechanism. And I doubt that one mechanism is enough anyway. And so, to me, it's a bit academic to some extent about whether we go down the ETS or a tax path, because, as I've explained, I think both have their flaws, both have their opportunities and their strengths and weaknesses. That said, if we move, for example, to a direct action approach, there would be another host of problems. Firstly, government grants to build power stations does not change the economic backdrop in favour of a low-carbon economy. It does not leverage the large swags of private investment that are out there and who are keen to build the right kind of technologies. Instead, it leaves the investment capital at best undirected and at worst going towards the wrong kinds of projects. Government allocation of resources can be haphazard. It can be politically interfered with, and again, we can all tell those stories. And it's certainly susceptible to being withdrawn, altered, allocated, rolled over, put into the out years. All of the things that have stymied the development of the renewable energy industry in Australia over the last two decades. And of course, direct action plans have to be paid for, and they're paid for by the taxpayer. Tony Abbott's direct action plan will slug Australian taxpayers, every single one of them, $720 a year, which will basically pay directly to the polluters. So the direct action model certainly has its shortcomings as well. Now, I've spoken about feed-in tariffs. They're a policy that does seek to leverage private investment, but rather than driving efficiency on the big polluters and other carbon-consuming industries, it provides incentives to investors to build the technologies that will deliver a clean energy future for this country. I doubt we are disagreement in this room that that renewable energy solutions need to be built. I think we might have disagreement about how they might be financed. However they are financed, the taxpayer or the consumer will invariably wear some of the cost of that transition. And feed-in tariffs are really just about spreading the cost across the entire electricity-consuming public. That's how they work. Every single electricity consumer pays to leverage the private investment to take the risk to build solar power stations or wind farms. Unfortunately, as I said, the feed-in tariffs have gotten a bit of a bad name in as much as they have primarily been introduced in Australia as a domestic solar scheme and have resulted in pitting neighbour against neighbour, or the haves and the have-nots against each other. Thanks. If feed-in tariffs had only been used for industrial scale development, as the Greens would have preferred, I doubt this misunderstanding would have occurred. We would have all just been paying a bit more for our power, knowing that we were helping to finance the new renewable energy station down the road that was giving us our clean green energy. And I think it's important to touch on the issue that feed-in tariffs and other green energy schemes are somehow driving the increase in electricity costs. Electricity in the ACT, and we've actually done pretty well compared to New South Wales and Queensland, has gone up around 50% in the last 5 to 6 years. The bulk of that cost increase has come from having to upgrade the grid, to pay to upgrade the ageing infrastructure. In New South Wales, it's worse. The price has gone up even more, and that's because governments over the last 30 to 40 years have not put the capital into our electricity networks. The Clean Energy Council commissioned research from independent energy market analyst Rome Consulting, who found that renewable energy schemes only contributed between 4 and 7% to power bills. Green energy is not driving up electricity prices. It's all about paying for the grid, and the grid's having to be upgraded to pay for all the air conditioning units that are being put into people's houses. That's the real story of electricity price increases. Peter's New South Wales example was interesting. He said 18% increase, and a third was due to renewables. What's the other two-thirds due to? That's the question that the critics of feed-in tariffs never ever answer. They're never ever honest enough to tell you what's really driving up the price of electricity. Now, in a recent article, Peter wrote that workers produce all the goods and services that keep society running. Their labour creates the profits that make the wealth richer and richer, the wealthy richer and richer. Yet workers do not make the decisions to invest in new coal-fired power plants, nor to chronically underfund public transport. Those who make the decisions, the corporate bosses and big shareholders, should pay. Similar comments to what he's made tonight. Now, I broadly agree with part of those comments. There is no doubt that we want the polluters to pay. But in the same article, he said that there is no fair price workers should have to pay on carbon. I believe that's a simplistic assertion that needs unpacking. At the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, the global community accepted the notion of common but differentiated responsibility. The idea that global problems, everyone has to play a part, but those parts will be different. Climate change is certainly a global problem, and even if communities don't consider themselves to have been a major part of the problem, Almost nobody can escape responsibility for taking action to implement the solutions. We have to work together. Now, undoubtedly, some must take greater responsibility, but to suggest there is no fair price that workers pay removes from debate the responsibility that workers have to make changes. And to put the cause of climate change at the feet of the capitalist class is an abdication of responsibility from all of us who have benefited from the fossil fuel age. Every single one of us in this room has benefited from the fossil fuel age. The capitalists may have built Hazelwood, but I doubt that the workers were complaining when the electricity came down the power cables. However, of course, we must fight for equity. I'm certainly not here to defend the capitalist system nor the capitalist classes, but I am here as a politician, I suppose, as someone who has to work in the world in which these are the systems that we need to try and change. We have to seek a fair deal, and we must compensate those who are disproportionately affected. Now, the Greens have been campaigning for a long time to ensure that particularly the most vulnerable in our community are protected. We've seen the Green movement pushing notions such as the just transition. I know Greenpeace did a great paper a couple of years ago. I should confess that I used to work for them, but it was after I'd moved on. But they did, you know, they've really looked long and hard at these. We've seen papers put together by the ACTU and the ACF showing that Australia could create 770,000 extra jobs by 2030 by taking strong action on climate change. These are jobs that are going to protect not just the working class, but the young people of Australia, the future generations that are coming after us. How am I going, Rick?
You've got 10 seconds.
Oh, jeez. So much more to say. Anyway, look, I guess what I'm trying to argue is that for the Greens, we are small in numbers, but we are having an impact. We are shifting this debate. We must work to protect those who are most vulnerable in our society. I think there are going to be flaws in the models we come up with, but we can't do nothing. I think we all have a responsibility to try and tackle climate change, and we all have a responsibility to keep fighting to make sure we do it the best and fairest way possible. I want to start with a bit of a philosophical perspective. I think the last 120 years or so of politics in Australia has been about fighting over the spoils of the planet. The Labor and Liberal parties, representing the workers and the capitalists respectively, have seen the earth as something to be exploited, and then the argument has been about who should get the spoils, the workers or the capitalists. Well, I don't think that cuts it in the 21st century, and that's why the Greens are on the rise as a political party. We need a new paradigm. We can no longer see this planet simply as an asset to be unsustainably exploited. It's no longer about a fight about who gets the riches of the earth, but rather about us working collectively together to ensure the very survival of our species, as well as recognising the intrinsic value of the earth and the rights of the other creatures who we share this planet with. That's the paradigm we have to start fighting in. We desperately need a decent public transport system in this town. We need one that runs 7 days a week so that all of us can catch buses on the weekend. But we cannot find agreement with the bus drivers to write a 7-day roster so we can run buses on Saturday and Sunday. That's the problem we have. I don't know how to get past that. I don't want to screw the bus drivers, but I want a decent bus system in this town. We have to find a solution to that. Natural gas. Natural gas is a problem. We need to skip straight past natural gas. It's going to lock up a lot of money, and those assets, people are going to demand a payback. I've put this question to ACTU-AGL. I said, if you build a $500 million gas fired power station in Canberra, how long will it take to get your return on investment? 40 years, they said. And I said, so if I want, in 15 years' time, to shut down the emissions coming out of the power station, you're going to make me pay you compensation. And they said, absolutely. So yes, gas is a problem. Someone picked me up on the use of the term real world. It was a fair cop. I didn't mean it to sound insulting, and I was rescued by my comrade from the Greens, turns out. I didn't, and that wasn't a setup. But his phrase that we're working with the tools and techniques we have is the point I was trying to convey. I think that's the struggle at the moment, is to sort of go, well, there's a really big crunchy system out there. We want to change it, but it's you know, turning the Titanic around, to use that great cliche. And similarly, on the notion of 6 out of 26, again, I wasn't meaning to sound that we don't have power. We will continue to argue for a position of integrity. It's just that at the end of the day, the way the system works is there's a vote. And I've been in the Assembly long enough to lose quite a few votes, 13 against 4, when the Labor and Liberal parties stack up against us. And it's just, there is that crunch moment where sometimes for all the good arguments and all the integrity in the world and putting a community view, there comes a moment when you get shafted. And it hurts. It really hurts. The last idea of the six that I want to quickly convey in this short 5 minutes is the need for mass movements. I could not agree more. I think it's actually saying it's come through as a theme tonight, probably in terms of a debate, is not very interesting because I probably fiercely agree with people on this. I've been kicking around politics for about 12 or 13 years now, seriously, inside politics, previously as an environmental activist with Greenpeace, and now as on the other side of the fence as a member of one of the parliaments in this country. Most politicians are not leaders. Most politicians will do what they think they can get away with in the public space. And the public space comes from people providing and demanding better solutions. And so that, absolutely, the gentleman over here put it very articulately, people need to stand up and say, we want something better. The gentleman up the back said, as consumers, we need to demand something better, or not consume, perhaps even better. But we need mass movements to create the space for the less leaderly politicians, and there's plenty of them, to actually have the courage to step up to the plate and accept that they can do something better than the trite they offer up so often these days. So on that note, power to the people. Thank you.
Okay, well, I also wanted to begin by, on a more philosophical note, because although I think the issue of climate change is one that has emerged relatively recently, actually the issue of environmental destruction is not such a new one. It's one that actually Karl Marx was quite familiar with. There's a quote out of Capital which I just wanted to read out. So, from the standpoint of a higher socioeconomic formation, the private property of particular individuals in the earth will appear just as absurd as the private property of one man in other men. Of course, Marx was writing in the 19th century and didn't use gender-neutral language. Even an entire society, a nation, or all simultaneously existing societies taken together are not owners of the earth. They are simply its possessors, its beneficiaries, and have to bequeath it to succeeding generations as boni patres familias, good heads of the household. But we don't have to wait around, as many people have made this point, for the revolution in order to do something about environmental destruction in the here and now. Concretely, I think it is pretty clear what we need. And we need a massive transition in many ways. So the issue of public transport producing more greenhouse gas emissions currently, I mean, I haven't looked at the spreadsheets myself, but I can believe that if there are a lot of empty buses running around because no one is using them because they don't run frequently enough, you know, maybe if you take that and divide it by the number of people who go on the buses, they produce more greenhouse gas emissions. But what we actually need is many more buses running much more frequently so many more people can use the buses. And beyond that, what we actually need is a public transport network that's not fueled by greenhouse gases anymore, that's fueled by renewable electricity. So this then takes you to the question, well, what are you going to do in the stationary energy sector, in the electricity generation sector? And that in turn requires a rapid transformation to renewable energy, as many people have been discussing. And again, like, what we actually need to do is in many ways take on the most difficult questions first, if we're to achieve a rapid transformation to renewable energy, or indeed in some ways any transformation at all, because what we really need is baseload renewable power, and that's going to require significant investments in making that efficient right now, the kind of investments that aren't going to be driven at all by a carbon price. You know, if you look concretely at what a carbon price will actually do, well, it is actually Christine Milne's policy that we should have a carbon price that facilitates the transition to gas. That's actually what they've been arguing with the Labor Party over just this week. Christine Milne says we should have a carbon price around $40 a tonne, which would be enough. And, you know, probably wants one higher, but what she'll really get is one around $40 a tonne that will start the transition to gas-fired power. But you need $70 a tonne for wind-fired power, and you need $200 a tonne to start to produce solar thermal. And I think this just shows the ludicrousness of relying on price signals to achieve this kind of a transition. But The other question is, what will a carbon price do politically? And this, I think, is the key question, because there was a poll out just this week saying support for a carbon tax is right down to around 30%, even though 70% of people think we should actually do something about climate change. So, like, clearly the support for these policies that are hitting working class consumers is one that's actually eroding support for real action on climate change. Or, I mean, 70% of people still think there should be action. So, I mean, you know, 40% of people have precisely the right position. What we need to do is mobilise the people who are both opposed to the enormous inequality that's been getting worse and worse in Australia and around the world for years and years. The share of income going to capital as opposed to labour has been rising and rising since the 1980s. What we need to do is take the enormous corporate profits that are being generated in Australia. We need to tax them. We need to turn them into public resources for investing in the concrete transition to a renewable energy-fueled economy. And while that doesn't necessarily need to wait to the revolution, I agree that it's an open question whether that could be achieved under capitalism. It's certainly something that cannot be achieved without an enormous mass movement in which the working class plays an absolutely central role. And that's why I'm opposed to policies that actually attack the working class and won't do anything to prevent the threat of climate change.